Hello and welcome to Around and About Chattanooga. I am Michael Edward Miller.
And I'm Garrett Crow, Gothic Garrett Crow.
Gothic Garrett Crow.
I can't introduce myself that way.
You can totally introduce yourself that way. Hello and welcome to Around and About Chattanooga. I am Michael Edward Miller.
And I'm Gothic Garrett Crow.
Gothic Garrett Crow. Well, that makes sense because today we're talking to a musician from Washington, D.C. who's written a book about the music industry. The book is called Supernatural Strategies for Making a Rock and Roll Group.
Supernatural Strategies. I need that.
I think you do need that.
What does that mean, though?
Okay, it's kind of convoluted, but in theory, the book is an occult guide to starting a band. It covers topics like how to name your band, how to pick out bandmates, what kind of van to drive, stuff like that.
Occultic methodology on how to start a band.
Well, okay, the author, Ian Svenonius, claims that he talks to the dead, specifically Jim Morrison, Buddy Holly, Jimi Hendrix, and all these other dead rock stars. They gave Svenonius advice about rock stardom, and so he wrote it down, and voila, you have a book.
Is this for real?
Well, here's how the publisher describes this book. I think this will answer your question. Akashic Books says, in their promotional materials for this book, it is, quote, an instructional guide, which doubles as a warning device, a philosophical text, an exercise in terror, an aerobics manual, and a coloring book.
I need that in every... I don't know. That's a guide that I need every day of my life, it sounds like.
I think really it could be more than just a guide to rock. It could be more because it really is a philosophical text. I think that's a better description than coloring book. Svenonius looks at the history of rock music from this strange, very specific, and very Marxist perspective that he has. He describes rock music as institutionalized dissent in the interview that I did with him.
You said Marxist?
Marxist.
Marxist ghost. That's like my favorite form of phantom.
I didn't know you had a favorite. It's really a funny book. It's totally ridiculous, but you know it's ridiculous to just kind of draw you in, and then like all satire, it makes some serious points among all the ridiculousness.
What kind of bands has Ian been in?
He's actually been in a lot of bands: Nation of Ulysses, The Makeup, Weird War, and Chain and the Gang. He's from Washington, D.C., and he was part of the big hardcore scene there that produced groups like Fugazi and Minor Threat. Pitchfork.com, that bastion of music wisdom, described him as a post-hardcore icon.
That whole Discord Records DC vibe, I get it. I'm with it.
Svenonius actually came here to Chattanooga recently. He did a book signing at the Winder Binder Gallery and Bookstore. I talked with him about his long career in music and his book. We're going to start out talking about that, Supernatural Strategies for Making a Rock and Roll Group.
If you want to start a rock and roll group, well, let me tell you what you got to do. You got to get this book, and you got to read it too.
But I can't read.
I can't read.
Well, get someone to read it for you. They're going to teach you how to slop, teach you how to bop, teach you how to roll, teach you how to stroll. Gonna teach you how to play guitar. Yeah, so you too could be a rock and roll star.
But I can't read.
I can't read.
We'll get someone to read it for you. Well, this book, Supernatural Strategies for Making a Rock and Roll Group, is gonna teach you everything that you need to know to create your own successful band. It's got a chapter on drugs. Got a chapter on naked love. It's a got a chapter on driving a car. Yeah, and how to be a big star.
I can't read. I can't read.
Yeah, get someone to read it.
The book Supernatural Strategies for Making a Rock and Roll Group. On first inspection, it's a how-to manual for making one's own rock and roll group. But it's But it was the information that's contained within was actually culled from by using seances with deceased rock stars.
I think it's funny because I've heard you say originally you'd intended to go out and interview living rock stars. What changed your mind and made you decide to do these seances and talk to Jim Morrison, Jimi Hendrix, people like that?
Well, because the living rock stars have a stake in the industry as it exists. So they're not interested in more competition from upstarts, young Turks, neophytes, and, you know, ingenues. They don't want us at their party, but the dead were much more magnanimous. They've got nothing to lose.
And when you communicated with them, it was in some pretty strange and elaborate ways. It wasn't a very straightforward kind of seance. What were some of the ways that the dead spoke with you?
Oh, you know, through, you know, just the usual things, dimmed light bulbs, the sputtering from a tea kettle, chains.
Spaghetti at one point.
Spaghetti being thrown at the wall, spelling things. Things like that.
It's really funny. You have this great part of the book where you tell the readers how to take the perfect rock and roll photograph. And what I like about it is you seem to give that priority over things like actually playing music.
Well, the rock and roll group is different than music. You know, we're talking about a rock and roll group. We're not talking about rock and roll music. We're talking about a very specific thing. What the rock and roll group is, you know, people say rock and roll came from the blues, and that's true. But the organizational model of the group is really comes out of the kind of street gang. You know, these kind of different, you know, these organizations that were, you know, from, you know, the lower classes that, you know, banded together.
Because you're talking about street gangs from like the 1950s. When you're a jet all the way.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's this whole idea of loyalty to the gang or group, and then the special outfits that you have to wear to distinguish oneself from the rest of society. The look and the attitude, the snarling attitude.
And so the rock groups kind of took that and appropriated it.
Or maybe they infused it with the kind of Protestant work ethic, maybe, you know. A group represents a kind of ideal, an ideal of living. And a lot of the rock groups that we know about and that are beloved and really influential, culturally influential, one might not even know their music. Like, I mean, the best example might be the Grateful Dead, where the Grateful Dead are known for LSD culture and the tie-dye and the bears and the skull with the roses. And everybody knows about, you know, Can I Get a Miracle? And the whole scene that surrounds a Grateful Dead concert. But very few people have listened to a Grateful Dead record.
Would you be willing to read an excerpt of the book?
Oh, sure. The group will be expected to perform its music live in concert for an audience. Though adults scoff at the affection which infants and animals have for repetition, children with their Teletubbies, for example, or dogs with their stick rituals, they expect the performer in a rock group to repeat things over and over again. The performer's body of work is expected to be cohesive and of a thread. They're supposed to play their hit songs dutifully at each concert and look the same their entire life, eternally youthful. Each day on tour is a repeat of the previous day. Each performance is expected to be essentially the same, and songs are expected to be verse and chorus repeated again and again. The solo, or free part of a song, which apparently defies the structure of a tune, is actually just a slight variation of the chords and notes that comprise the song. The solo is a tease of chaos, a moment of anxiety before order is restored with the return of the comforting chorus galloping over the hill like the proverbial cavalry. What is at the root of this desire on the part of the audience for the group or performer to repeat the same thing again and again, like some brainless machine? Answer: the desire to be a brainless machine.
And one of the things that you say in the book is the theory that rock music, in spite of being anti-establishment, was really in many ways used as an establishment tool to fight communism. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, during the ideological struggle of the Cold War, you have two different ideas at play against one another. which are striving to capture the hearts and minds of the so-called third world, or the less, you know, the less developed, you know, economies of the world. So you have the communists who are talking about this egalitarian model of like sharing wealth and reappropriating the possessions of the rich. And then on the other side, you have the capitalists who are talking about wealth and really freedom. You know, they're talking about this idea of freedom. So one of the main strategies for the USA in the struggle was to show dissent, you know, within the, you know, the dissent that was allowed to exist in the country. So the idea of showing rock and roll as this kind of institutionalized dissent, which was very apolitical, which was, you know, people kind of acting out a tantrum, which mimicked kind of psychotic behavior or juvenile delinquency, was very attractive because it's sort of rebellion without any ideology or any apparent ideology.
How do we describe our sound? Something we just found. Yeah, we dug it up out of the ground.
Just joining us, I'm talking to Ian Svenonius. His latest book is called Supernatural Strategies for Making a Rock and Roll Group. He's also been in several bands. I think we're going to hear some tracks right now from those bands just to kind of demonstrate the range of music you've been involved in. The first one we'll hear is from Nation of Ulysses. It's called Ulithium. It's from an album called 13-Point Plan to Destroy America, is what it's called?
Program.
13-Point Program.
Yeah.
That is a great title.
Thanks.
Let's hear that. And this one is from Chain in the Gang, which is one of your latest ventures, from the album Music's Not for Everyone. This is a song called Not Good Enough.
If you feel like you're not good enough, then you're probably not.
And you know what? You never ever will be.
If you feel like you're not good enough, then you're probably not.
And you know what?
Tongue gets tied, and you're sick inside, and your palms get wet, and you break out in a sweat. You're just too shy, but you can't make eyes, then you're not cut out, and you know what, if you feel like you should.
Just the range of music you've done, from, you know, really loud, aggressive punk rock like Nation of Ulysses, to a bit more mellow, subdued, and really sarcastic song like Not Good Enough. How have you evolved over the years? Have you deliberately tried to change styles? Do you just get bored after a while?
Well, yeah, I think that you just get interested in performing in different ways, communicating in different ways. I loved being in Nation of Ulysses because it was a very physical communication, but I also like to, you know, communicate in other ways. Yeah. And I think that a lot of it has to do with who you're collaborating with and the chemistry that occurs between people, obviously.
Well, when you're starting a group like Chain in the Gang, a lot of the songs are really funny, really sarcastic. I mean, was that something you were deliberately doing and you were seeking out musicians who shared that vision? Did it just kind of naturally evolve, maybe?
No, that was much more deliberate because it was sort of a solo, or it began as sort of my solo group. So that was an attempt to make like a beatnik-spoken jazz record, you know, like Rod McEwen's masterpiece called Rod McEwen Takes a San Francisco Hippie Trip.
Elsa says to really get to know someone, you have to hold their head while they vomit. And Elsa said,
it's a Rod McEwen record of like beatnik jazz musings. It's very funny, and really, it's just great, great record.
I want to play another one of your songs. This one is from a group called Felt Letters. This is 600,000 Bands.
Yeah. 600,000 bands. Each one makes a sound. Well, everybody wants you to listen to them, but you can't right now, cause you're listening to this. 600,000 bands, yeah. Beatles, Stones, and the Damned. Some other ones have formed for various reasons. No one knows why or when, yeah. 600,000 bands. 600,000 bands. 600,000 bands. 600,000 bands. 600,000 bands, yeah. 50,000 sound like can. 50,000 sound like man for man. I'm starting one like I'm cooling the gang, yeah. Come on now. Yeah, I'm going to festival, man. Yeah, who you going to see? Oh, I don't know.
And obviously the sentiment behind that is kind of, I don't know, horror at just the amount of bands that are, not that are out there, because they've always been out there, but just the fact that now through the internet you can actually be aware of all 600,000 of them.
That's the problem. People think there's more bands now than there were, but I don't think there are. It's just that we're supposed to be aware of everything simultaneously. And it's bad for our egos because we don't feel special. It's bad for people's, you know, psychology, I think, just feeling like they have to know everything. You know, it's sort of like the news cycle where you're just learning about some horrendous incident in Bangladesh at the same time as some horrible, you know, I think people have to, yeah, I don't know, for their own sanity, people should get local, you know, but maintain an international awareness.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think it, you know, it starts at home. We've got to, you know, take care of business at home. If we don't want the corporations to rule every aspect of our life, you know, we have to create local culture, you know.
How do you deal with just the amount of stuff out there? I mean, I've often thought maybe the best approach would be to just refuse to listen to anything that's been recorded after, you know, a certain date, kind of like the Amish refuse to adopt technology after a certain date.
Yeah, well, no, I think that's not the answer, but I do think that, yeah, we need rules, we need guidelines, but they shouldn't be based on dismissal of other forms. It should be based on celebration of a particular form. You know,
if you're just joining us, I am talking to Ian Svenonius. His book is about supernatural strategies for forming a rock and roll group. And you've said this is not a practical how-to book. It's not like Rock and Roll for Dummies. It's more of a philosophical kind of book.
It's a treatise. Yeah. It's a treatise, and it's not. Yeah, it's very. It's essentially countering all the practical knowledge with some very impractical knowledge. Because I don't think a rock and roll group should just be a practical exercise. In fact, a rock and roll group is, even at its most successful, a great exercise in poetic futility. I mean, the Beatles broke up acrimoniously, and they might be the most successful group ever, but they're also, like every relationship, you know, it's a boondoggle.
Well, we are...
I think an expiration date can be good.
We're in Winderbinder, and of course, the dog that lives here at Winderbinder keeps coming back.
Yeah, I guess we should go.
Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you. Thanks for coming down here.